1911, in September, there was a big race. It wasn't a sports race. It was more important than sports. It was a race for the bragging rights between two countries to be the first to land on the South Pole. To be the first to take their flag and say, I claim this land for. The first country was Great Britain, who took one of the naval officers in its royal fleet, took 65 of their best officers, put them together, invested a lot of money in 5 different means of transportation. And there was the smaller, humbler Norwegian team who said, we want to do this too. We don't have the money that Great Britain has. We don't have the ship that they have. We don't have the funds that they have. Whatever, we'll have a team of 19 instead of 65. Our budget will be half. Our ship size will be half. And, you know, we can't afford as much transportation, so we'll select our pack of dogs that will lead us through to the promised land of the South Pole. They all parked themselves 400 miles away from the South Pole. And the surprise was, the smaller, humbler Norwegian team not only got there first, but was also the only team that made it back to tell the story and survived. And the question that was asked by historians, psychologists, everybody, is how did it happen? How did it work? How could it be the smaller team beat the larger fleet and force of the Royal British Army? Rabim be'adat ma'atim. So last week, when you were all in Eilat, my wife and I were traveling as well, and we read a book. The book is called Great at Work. It's a book of managerial strategies. And he talks about the story, and he gives his own angle. I want to share the angle with you. And the angle that he has is as follows. He says the royal officer who was in charge of the British fleet, the British team that lost, let's be honest, he had a lot of things on his plate that week, that month, that year. This was one of his many responsibilities. And he delegated 10 other people to do the research for him. And he had other people try on, try out, figure things out. Sure, he was fully with it once he was on, but, you know, he didn't invest that much into it. In contrast, the Norwegian team leader was the person who, of course, motivated this entire thing and spent 6 months dreaming and obsessing about it. He planned every detail to the T. He traveled to 4 countries to choose the breeder for the dogs that he wanted to take with him. And he personally made sure of the training and every ounce of food and every little thing. Because when you obsess over something, which is the theme of the book, the results are better. And the thesis that he has in this book in general isn't the more the better, the more things you know, the more projects you're involved in, the more titles you have. Less is more, or the title of the book, or the subtitle. Do less and obsess. Which basically means, you know, it's not as right in the medical field. A general doctor today is the lowest guy on the totem pole. Specialize. But don't just specialize. I need you to obsess over what you're specializing in. Pick your specialty, pick your focus, and that's all you think about. That's all you dream about. That's where your mind is at every point during the day. Okay, this guy, this captain, this Norwegian captain, all he did all day was focus on when he was buying shoes, what shoes would he wear and would his team wear? What food would he be bringing? Okay, his family reported that he was basically totally not with them the entire time. All he did was obsess. When you do less, but you obsess, the results are greater. What he tries to develop is, he talks about 25% greater results by obsessing. And I sat back on the plane as we were reading this, and I said, wow, I wonder how this would apply to Torah, to learning Torah. What would it mean to obsess over learning Torah. No, because deep down I have a feeling that, you know, when I look at my fellow Rebbeim here, I would be willing to bet that Rav Alex and Rav Grummet obsess over Tanakh for several decades. They lived and breathed it. They read every book in the library that quoted it or that might have quoted it, or they saw a book, an atlas of a map, and immediately they went towards an area of, a country from Sefer Yirmiyahu that they had been recently looking at. They obsessed. I imagine you're a Gemara Rebbeim, obsessed about Gemara, about anything related to Gemara. And the result of obsession is intense focus, and such an intense focus that it becomes you. That everything you do is, you know, you see it through the eyes and the lens of what you're doing. I wonder what happened if we all thought about obsessing over Torah, and if we all tried it. Now, I have a feeling that all of us know how to obsess, and that every single person in this room has obsessed over something or somebody or some goal at some point in their lives. You've obsessed over a job, over an internship, over a test that you spent 3 weeks obsessing about and studying for, over a term paper, over getting into something. You all know how to do it. I'm probably sure you've obsessed over, I'm going to finish a 7-series TV show in 2 weeks. That's a formidable challenge. And yet, if you do it obsessively enough, I bet you that many of us have tried and succeeded. Because when you obsess about something that's important for you, you'd be amazed at what you can accomplish. What would it take for everyone to choose one thing, Torah, to obsess about? You know, Baruch Hashem, we're in yeshiva with a full day schedule. You learn a little Gemara in the morning, and some Tanakh in the afternoon, and some Halacha, and at night, say, you read this book. And just be clear, it's all wonderful and great. Perhaps it's why we came to Eretz Tzvi. Perhaps it's why we teach at Eretz Tzvi. But you're not obsessing over anything. What would happen if for the next month you obsessed over one topic, one book, passionately focused, intense, every moment of your day, of your week, of your month? All you're focused on is Yirmiyahu, is how to read Gemara, is Mor Nevuchim. Choose the topic to obsess about, and let the power of obsession drive you to greater results. Now, as I was thinking about this, I realized it's actually an explicit Tosfot. There's Gemara in Brachot and Daf Yud. It talks about Birchat HaTorah. And there are two questions that the Balei HaTosfot ask. Ready? We all say this bracha every morning. La'asok b'divrei Torah. Tosfot asks two questions. Question number one is word choice. What in the world is la'asok? I mean, we have lots of mitzvot. Ready? Have you ever said la'asok b'lulav? La'asok b'tfilin? No! You don't say to deal with tfilin. You say la'aniach tfilin, to put it on. You say take the lulav. What's osik? Second question that bothers Tosa is, why do we only say the bracha in the morning? Understand, you have 3 siddurim, so you should make lasuk b'divrei Torah in the beginning of morning seder, you should make it in the beginning of afternoon seder, and then make it again at night seder. Oh, or by the way, it could be if you go to the bathroom in the middle of seder, or take a phone call, and you go outside and you're on a break, maybe you should say it again when you come back. Why is he only say it once? What does Tosa say? I think Tosa says, if Torah is your obsession, then you're always thinking about Torah. And then there's no break. There's no morning division between morning, night, and day. The Gemara, the Torah, whatever you're thinking about, is always with you. And that's why you don't say it more than once. And that's why it says la'asok. You know what it means, la'asok? It means it's sitting on your mind. You're involved in it constantly. That's the bracha of la'asok b'divrei Torah. Being osik b'Torah means obsessing in Torah. Maybe if we all would obsess a little about learning, about one thing in learning for the next month, not for your life, not for all of eternity, for the next week, obsess over one thing and perhaps see what a difference it makes.